Hi, I'm Tara, and welcome to Sagas and Sass Season 4, brought to you by Geek Saga Entertainment.
I'm fellow Sagas and Sass host Jonathan, and this is episode 67 of Sagas and Sass, covering Lysander's POV chapters from Mischief, Part 1 of Dark Age, which is the fifth installment in Pierce Brown's Red Rising saga.
And I'm yet another host, Nick, here to remind you that our Red Rising coverage is spoiler-free outside of the chapters we cover in each episode. Oh, and as always, the opinions of those of us as individuals do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the show as a whole. Though, let's be real, it almost always is. Or, if not exactly the same page, we're usually pretty close to it.
Last but not least, don't forget to check out our Patreon with 10 tiers ranging from $1 a month to $40 a month. It offers tons of ways to support us and receive some great perks in return, including access to the video recordings of these episodes, which apparently also will include some hilarious outtakes within 24 hours of us recording them, usually less, and early access to our podcast episodes. You can find us at patreon.com/geeksaga_entertainment.
We might have left Lysander in the Rim, and we wish he had stayed there, but alas, he has made his way to Mercury with Rim Ambassador Diomedes, and for some reason, Serafina by his side. Because even though it should have taken them 3 months to make the trip, it didn't. Not that Diomedes wants Atalanta to know that. In fact, it seems the only reason they tagged along at all is because they believe, or at least want to believe, that Lysander truly does want to make Gold Hole, and that he doesn't want to seize the throne. Now, Lysander just has to hope that Atalanta believes that as well, especially considering he is the legal heir of House Loon, meaning that much of what she now owns is, well, technically his. Upon boarding Atalantia's ship, the Annihilo? Annihilo? How would you pronounce that?
I would say Annihilo or Annihilo. Do you remember how it said it in the book, Nick?
Annihilo.
Annihilo, okay.
Annihilo. Lysander and the Ra's are greeted by Ashguard decked out in field armor rather than the ceremonial armor they should be wearing for receiving enemy dignitaries. Oh, and they totally don't believe he is who he says he is. But when the DNA test comes back showing he's 100% that bitch, 100% Lysander Alun, the love knight Kilindora softens to him, and Ajax even embraces him and calls him brother.
Granted. The mood quickly sours when the Core Golds mock Cassius, his death, and even Diomedes as he stands right in front of them. To make matters worse, Ajax gets all whiny about how he is the Storm Knight and demands that Diomedes remove his cloak, which Diomedes does, only to have Ajax rip it from his hands and pee on it. Bruh, you made one person look bad there, and it wasn't Diomedes. Ugh. Listen, if we really wanted to get into it, we could talk about how Ajax then mocked stomping in Diomedes and Serafina's older sister's head, but let's just say we probably don't need to try very hard to make Ajax look any worse. Now, Ajax is one thing, but Atalantia is, well, something else. Bitch goes around wearing a super poisonous snake as jewelry and paints out the faces of her dead family members in their family mural. She also kind of drags Lysander into a meeting with her so-called allies, who immediately start questioning whether he is an agent for the Rising and don't seem too happy that he was Cassius's ward, of all things. To shake things up a bit more, the Ra's get dragged into the meeting as well, and for good measure, they get mocked some more. Seriously, it really doesn't seem like a good idea for these Core Golds to be treating Diomedes like this, especially, but at this point, Lysander kind of finally sticks up for his moony friends by taking the Core Golds down a peg, because there's clearly some shit going on that they don't want to own up to. Mainly, they don't really have the ability to fix their ships, and despite the fact that they might be winning at other things, Darrow is Darrow, and gonna Darrow, so... Finally, they agree to a sort of tentative temporary alliance that involves Serafina agreeing to fall in their iron reign. But the moment the Ra's are ushered from the room, Ajax rounds on Lysander and cracks him right across the jaw over the whole being Cassius's ward thing. This guy, y'all. But between Ajax and Atalantia, Lysander allows himself to be goaded into offering himself up to fall in the reign as well. I mean, he's kind of earned that peerless scar, right? Insert eye roll here. So Lysander joins the ranks, hears the benedictions, and then finds out that Atalantia is sending Ajax to take Heliopolis, and apparently plans to keep it despite her promises to her Votum allies. Between this and Lysander's disgust for Serafina's hunger for war, he goes into his star shell feeling, well, not so great about things.
Oh, and things only get worse for this little baby. The sims he trained in didn't quite train him well enough for how touchy the actual machinery is. Not to mention, you know, the whole messiness of an actual battle. While he lands on Mercury unscathed, his targeting data picks up a pocket of civilians in a nearby basement so that an orbital strike can be used to take them out. And sympathizers or not, there were quite a few children among them. I mean, Lysander, what the fuck did you think was going to happen? Then, when nearly 1,000 Praetorians arrive to help, they kneel for Lysander, which is no thanks to Kalandora, who told them who he was. And we say, no thanks to that, because this whole situation is not going to help Lysander prove his loyalty to Atalantia. Oopsies! But their little reunion, as well as Ajax's plans for Heliopolis, are interrupted by the arrival of Darrow's Hypercane. And Lysander's intel on the Storm Gods doesn't do him any favors either, because apparently Grandma didn't trust her allies and hid some weapons of mass destruction. We don't know anything about that, though, do we? Seriously, these golds, man. However, Lysander does think this might give him another chance to prove himself to Ajax and Atalantia. So with Kalandora, Serafina, and his Praetorians in tow, he's off to see a little storm god. They slowly but surely push through the storm and are eventually joined by Cicero, the heir of House Votum, and some of his troops. By the way, we know that his father died, but Cicero doesn't. By the time they reach the machine they mean to destroy, their energy cores are nearly depleted, and before they can even begin their little assault, a railgun flashes from the Storm Gods, and oh, Serafina just got torn in half. Too bad. So sad. Maybe you shouldn't have loved war so much, bitch. Really, though, no time to mourn, even if we wanted to. While the battle isn't quite fought on page, it's hard won, with Lysander apparently forging ahead alone to shoot his final missile into the Storm God's gravity engines. So now the time for Ajax to pick them up has come and gone, and just as Lysander is facing the fact that they've probably been abandoned thanks to Ajax being, well, a huge dick, they hear Drakenjaegers approaching. And it's not just Drakenjaegers they hear, because these particular mechs come with their own theme song. Or maybe rather a theme howl. Needless to say, it's a slaughter, the center of which swirls a god of death, Darrow himself, of course. Lysander plunges forward, shouting, "Kill the Reaper!" But it's he who is cut down and then pinned beneath a star shell as another downed shell near him catches fire. And as the wolf howls fade into the distance, Lysander begins to burn. Can you tell how much I love Lysander?
Kill the Reaper!
What a fucking pixie.
No, he's in Iron Gold, remember? We heard that in Iron Gold, the book that we...
Also, he has to constantly remind us how great he is. But not without a little dash of humility, because also, he doesn't have a scar.
Also, LOL, golds being golds and thinking that Lysander's return is just a ploy for him to seize the throne. But hey, the Ra's at least will have no part in kingmaking.
Lysander gives his word that he wants nothing of the sort, thinking, damn my inheritance. All that matters is that we still the turmoil that racks the worlds. Gold remains the only viable peacemaker, but not while gold is itself divided. To defeat Darrow, we must heal the wounds between the rim and the core. For that, I sacrifice Cassius. For that, I would sacrifice myself.
But he also, like, doubts, aka kind of knows that Atalantia would not sacrifice herself for the same thing, because she just wants power and stuff.
Speaking of Atalantia, Diomedes says to Lysander, "My father once said anyone interesting is at war with themselves and can thus be described in just two words. What are Atalantias?" And the answer is snake charmer.
But Lysander replies, "Velvet buzzsaw. Atalantia has a savage brain and immensely contagious charisma. She is hindered by neither guilt nor doubt. She knows no half measures. She is a social strategist, a herpetologist, a sculptor, a laughing, masterful woman in love with the sound of her own voice, and convinced that beauty is the pinnacle of existence in any form. But hey, he doesn't mention her vices. It would be improper for Diomedes to ask, and he doesn't. I roll.
Honestly, like, I love how Lysander literally thinks, like, oh, I'm not going to mention her vices. And Diomedes, like, he won't ask because it's improper to ask. But she is hindered by neither guilt nor doubt. She's in love with her own voice. Like, you yeah. absolutely did just list vices.
There's a lot of vices in there, buddy. You apparently don't understand what vices are, which is evident by your own behaviors.
Vices? You keep saying that word. I don't think it means what you think it means. So Lysander is still haunted by his grandmother's axioms, including when she told him, "Fear those who seek your company for their own vanity. As soon as you eclipse them in the mirror, it won't be the mirror they break." Which actually is a pretty legit thing to say. But while Lysander keeps telling himself he has no desire to rule, he also knows it won't be easy to convince others, including Atalantia, of that. He doesn't know how she'll react and asks Diomedes if he is frightened.
Diomedes replies, "To meet Atalantia? Conditionally. To see my uncle again? Certainly."
By the way, his uncle, Diomedes' uncle, is Atlas Ara, the Fear Knight, the one who's impaling people and cutting off fingers and putting rats in buckets to eat off their faces and all sorts of shit. So Lysander is also worried about meeting the Fear Knight, which says something.
I don't know why that makes him scary, though.
That was a joke, right, Jonathan?
Yeah. Yes. I needed
confirmation because the way you said it, I wasn't sure.
You were very deadpan.
I really just needed you to be explicit that was a joke.
Definitely sarcasm there.
Now, again, obviously Lysander is who he says he is, and the DNA test proves it. But his, I guess, wannabe allies, at least wannabe for him, don't believe he's like totally legit because he was in the Dragon Maw when it fell. And, you know, how did he survive? They wonder if he's an agent of the Rising and if he even knows himself, because they no longer hold the monopoly on certain .. technologies, which is an interesting thing to put in the back of our minds or in our pockets, whatever. Now, Lysander does recognize that the archtraitor of my people raised me just as long as our dead sovereign did. While they might spit at me, it has a corrosive effect on their condescension. Bellona's blood was as old as theirs, and he was a very dangerous man. What did he help raise? What indeed, Lysander?
The answer is an asshole.
Yeah. How could you blame Cassius for that, though? There is definitely some other shit going on with Lysander. There's other shit going on with him.
Lysander is proof of my theory that when it comes to nature versus nurture, it's 90% nature.
Wow. Well, to be fair, you can't really say that, though, because he's had 50% nurture, quote-unquote, from Octavia, and 50%...
Well, that's true.
Well, Octavia, Aja, Atalantia, Calendora, and 50%
nurture that's from fair.
Cassius. So, going back to Ajax, though, honestly, fuck Ajax for going at Diomedes, because they both wear the Stormknight crest.
Which Diomedes insists is not his crest any more than it was the crest of the man that came before him. It represents an idea, in our case, humility.
Ajax asks, "Humility? And how is that?"
Diomedes schools him, "A man is nothing before the storm."
But Ajax gonna Ajax, saying, "I am the storm. Take it off." So, okay, Diomedes finally agrees to take it off, and then Ajax pisses on his cloak. Why with the fucking peeing, Pierce?
Would you have preferred
Pierce has a pee kink. I'm sorry to call you out like this, Pierce Brown, but you 100% have a piss kink, because why else would you include so much pissing in your books?
I mean, really, I think it's just a reference to like animals like marking their territory and stuff.
Yes, yes. But and also humiliation, which is its own kink, Pierce, and it's okay. I'm not here to kink shame you.
Yes, we do not kink shame. Hashtag.
I'm just here to acknowledge you, Pierce.
But still, really though, how dare you, Ajax? Who the fuck are you? Like, we just met you and we already don't like you, okay? And it was even before he did this to Diomedes, but how dare you with Diomedes? And granted, all we know of Diomedes is that he has seemed to be like super honorable from day one, maybe minus the fact that he tossed Lysander out the bottom of the ship on Io and let him like be exposed to the element, but also kind of Lysander, so who cares? But generally, Diomedes has been a pretty legit dude. And he's being a super legit dude in this case because like the Rim doesn't necessarily need to ally with the Core Golds. It's just Dido that's kind of driving this whole alliance slash force because she wants war. And I just feel like this is gonna not turn out well for, I hope that this does not turn out well for Ajax, because I want to see Diomedes rip a new one on some of these people, because I like Diomedes, honestly.
100%. Yes, please.
And Lysander also likes Diomedes, and I don't necessarily love Lysander's opinions as a whole, but he does do a very good job of describing Diomedes. Maybe that's what Lysander is actually good at, is he's just good at like telling us how other people are good.
He's just good at describing people.
He does it with Darrow later too. He swirls like a god of death and all this other shit, and it's like, you aren't really good at anything you're doing, but you are very good at making us like other people. Even Darrow in that moment, who we have problems with right now. All that said, Lysander is kind of ballsy in his desperation to convince the Core Golds to ally with the Rim, even accusing them of betraying Apple, which is why he claims that Apple was part of killing Magnus, aka the Ash Lord.
Lysander believes that Apple was probably betrayed because of his popularity, and he feels a sense of loneliness as he muses, these are the people who Cassius thought would send assassins for him, like the ones he judged so much worse than the Rising that he gave his life to ensure they never won this war. They not even agree to entertain the idea of allying with the Rim, then he died for nothing.
God, I will like literally always have to mute myself when you read these Lysander quotes. And I gave you pretty much all of the Lysander quotes, so this is going to be a fun episode.
Keep giving them to me. I want them.
Your voice is not how I had his voice in my mind, though.
I am curious, because you said that you didn't care for the narrator for Lysander, I think. So why is that?
So part of it is that he doesn't use the affected voice that I use, which I think is perfect for Lysander, and so obviously it's best. But really, part of it is, and this is entirely subjective, obviously, but I feel like he's trying to give like a gravitas to Lysander, and it's similar to the way that the voice actor for Darrow reads and some of the other things that I've listened to have been read. And I just don't feel like Lysander can be read that way because he is a very uncertain character. At least in my reading of him, he is convinced of very specific ideals, wrong ideals, terrible ideals, but he's convinced of them, but he's unsure about everything else. And he doesn't know how to navigate any of this while also saying that he's an amazing diplomat. And to me, he's a very complicated character. He is a character who is extremely young, has been raised in isolation both by his grandmother first in this very like secluded way within society and being raised as like the upper echelons of society and so shielded from a lot. And that's something that I think has its own challenges with it. But then also he was isolated because of the very real events that happened and the way that he was then raised for the next 10 years of his life. Because again, he's only 20 years old. First 10 years, he's raised in upper echelons of the society by his grandmother, basically raised to become her successor as sovereign. Next 10 years, he's raised in almost complete isolation. He only really gets to interact with Cassius and Pythus. And is being taught very different values. And yet, he still stubbornly sticks to those first 10 years of education, basically ignores everything that Cassius and Pytha try to teach him, even to the point where when we see Pytha in these chapters of the book, it's almost like he doesn't understand her. And she certainly is like, who the fuck are you? You are basically betrayed everything of who you were. So to me, if you're obviously I'm doing a very ridiculous version of Lysander. I don't pretend anything other. But I think if you're going to do that character justice, he needs to be very confused. He needs to be almost constantly vacillating in his opinions and his ideas, because we also get insights specifically into him trying to not use some of the methods that his grandmother taught him, but then having to fall back on them. And if you think about that from a mental health trauma perspective, like, that makes a lot of sense to me. But if it's being read in a very, like, I'm an adult, I know what's going on way, like Darrow has been read, which, again, there's reasons why that might not be the best choice for Darrow, because Darrow also has a lot of conflicting things going on for him. But particularly with Lysander, who's 20 years old, he spent half his life, first 10 years of his life in absolute, like, upper echelons, half his life in absolute isolation, and is trying to figure out what the fuck is going on. Like, there should be a degree of that in the voice actor's portrayal of, I don't know, and I am really struggling to try to figure that out. And when you read him like a character like Darrow, I lose any sympathy at all for that. So that's why I struggle with it. And this isn't actually necessarily specific to that voice actor. I think they changed voice actors between Iron Gold and Dark Age. Yeah. I didn't really care for either one. And again, because I don't feel like anyone has really brought the complexity to that character that could make him in even the slightest bit sympathetic. It's very hard to sympathize with him at all, but I think you could make him a more sympathetic character if you added some more of that, I'm trying to figure this out, I'm doing the wrong thing, I'm making bad choices, which you see when during the rain, he gives the coordinates and then they're immediately used to slaughter people who are likely innocent civilians. And he talks about, like, oh, I'm conflicted about this and I'm kind of disgusted by these people that I see as my family, but they aren't actually the people that I thought that they were. They are a different group of people. And if you played into that confusion, that struggle, I think it could be very powerful. As it is, fuck that guy.
This is jumping forward a little bit in the notes, but because you brought up the targeting data that was used on a group of civilians that included a bunch of children, and Lysander gets mad about it, which, like, good, I guess. But also he recognizes that he knew war wouldn't be clean. And I guess he kind of finally begins feeling that the sense of certainty and purpose that brought him to where he is fading. And he feels like a boy from the crowd who thought he could tame lions by stepping in a cage with them. I'm going to break some of these other notes out because we'll get into that a little more later. But yeah, I mean, I agree with you. And the thing is, like, maybe listening to it gives you a little bit of a different perspective if he seems very sure of himself. But when you're reading it, absolutely, he vacillates between feeling one way and another constantly. He'll feel good about something, and then immediately that feeling good about something is taken away by the way these people are acting. And one of the things is, like, he eventually admits that he was in fact Cassius's ward, because they're in this meeting and I can't remember who, I think it might be a Votum or a Carthii. It's one of the other golds keeps calling him Cassius's catamite.
I think it might be Scorpio.
Yeah. Which is a young boy who is the intimate companion of an older man. Lysander is finally like, no, I was his ward, you know, for lack of a better word. And not surprisingly, the Korgolds do not like this. Ajax is especially ripshit. After all, Cassius did kill his mother. But Lysander just claims that he was afraid to return to them being like the Korgolds, his, I guess, extended family, really, because he saw how they did the rising to themselves, that the Jackal, Fitchner, Cassius, and the Martian feud were all symptoms of the same disease, and Lysander wanted no part of it. It's interesting to me that he lumps Fitchner in and even Cassius in with the Jackal, but fine, whatever.
And that Ajax understands, because as Lysander notes, as children, we mocked all the scheming snakes of the court. Only Atalantia ever made it look good anyway, and she did it for laughs. Moira was pure in her obsession for truth. Aja, pure in her duty to grandmother. Lorne, pure in his honor. Even Darrow was pure in his, then, inexplicable lust to win. Those were the people we admired, not the snakes.
It's interesting that you admired Darrow along with all these other people, but
also the reference to snakes when he's also just been talking about how Atalantia is a herpetologist and has
the most venomous snake.
Yeah.
You brought up Pytha. I love that Pytha is so concerned about Lysander falling in the rain. He thinks she wouldn't know anything about them, but she admits that she's been in one. She and Cassius kept her past from Lysander because Cassius didn't want him to only know warriors. And Pytha tells Lysander, this isn't what he would have wanted for you. Ever since he died, something's woken up in you. A machine in your brain. It's not you. This isn't you. Or have you just always been desperate to be in Iron Gold?
Lysander claims that's only a small part of it, because mostly he believes that if Gold loses, the Republic will fracture, and this will lead to war that lasts 300 years. He says, you think this is just about me? It isn't. Darrow thinks this is about good and evil. It isn't. This is about order and chaos. I have chosen my side, but to have a voice, I must have a scar.
Okay, if you're going to continue to do silly voices, I think the next one needs to be in the voice of Alvin the Chipmunk.
I don't know what you're talking about, Jonathan. I have not done any silly voices.
This isn't silly at all. This is totally legit.
This is how I hear Lysander in my head. I'm just sharing it with you and our listeners.
So you don't think of him as Alvin from Alvin and the Chipmunk?
No, I don't think of him that way.
I mean, honestly, that may not be the worst comparison.
It's not the worst comparison, but that's not how I think of him. I think of him as a whiny little brat.
Well, Pytha calls him arrogant and tells him that respect and being honorable aren't going to get him anywhere. She tells Lysander that he needs to make them fear him or he's for the worms.
Before we move forward, I just got to say, like, I really hate how this is. And obviously, I don't know Pierce's intentions or what happens next, because I try to only read what we are reading for the specific podcast. It feels like it's being set up that, like, oh, Lysander has to step in and take charge because none of the other golds really understand what it means to rule. And it just fucking disgusts me. We can move on.
The moving on is all you, because there's a long ass.
I know. Next. A fucking course Lysander falls in the rain on Mercury, and his thoughts, as he does, definitely start out reflecting that arrogance that Pytha noted. There is time enough to be lost in the majesty and to remember my nature did not provide this with her careless hand. My race of mortals carved this paradise from irradiated rock and violent gas by channeling the greatest virtues of all men in common cause. A patriotic pride that I did not know I possessed fills me. The same blood flows through my veins as the man who sent the last of the Lovelock engines and storm gods here. But this zeal evaporates as soon as I realize I do not belong to the age of giants who made this, but to a smaller, meaner age where men think war the height of human endeavor. I laugh at the cosmic joke. Only humanity could grasp the stars and then let them slip through its fingers for the pettiness in its heart. But I feel hope. That pettiness that defined my grandmother's age, it may yet not define ours. But then Ajax makes a joke about whether everyone kept their food down during the launch, and others respond with laughter and rebarbs, leading Lysander thinking, do they really love this? What creatures could be so at ease here and now? Am I even the same species?
I would love to hear both of your thoughts on the evolution of Lysander's thought process here, because, like, he starts by thinking, the majesty, I can do all these things. My race of mortals carved this paradise. And he feels all this pride. And then he's like, oh, wait, never mind. I'm part of this age where men think war is, like, the best thing. And it's hilarious. Not really sarcastically hilarious, but he feels hope. He wants the pettiness that defined his grandmother's age not to define the current age. And then Ajax just busts in like, did you keep your food down? And Lysander is just, wait, they actually love this? Am I even like one of them? And I just, the evolution of his thoughts here, or evolution, de-evolution, it's like evolution, de-evolution, and I don't even know. Thoughts, please.
Well, I mean, I must admit, I always thought of Lysander's voice as the upper class twit from the old Monty Python skits myself. I find him, quite honestly, totally insufferable. I don't even know where he's coming from. After living on the Rim for a decade, granted, I know his upbringing when he was up to 10 was...
It was abusive.
Well, honestly, it was abusive, but also raised differently. I don't see how the... In my experience, you grew most between 10 and 25, not 0 to 10, but... I would expect he would have seen some growth here.
He's very much like backtracking, right? Whatever growth he had during his time with Cassius is just kind of taking a back seat to his need to fix things, because he just suddenly believes that he is part of this gold group that will like shepherd the low colors back to where they all need to be and like protect the low colors and everything. It's just gross. He's gross.
It is. And it, you know, it actually runs really parallel to something that I have been thinking about, which is it sometimes feels like Lysander is a parallel, or maybe parallel is not the right word, but like mirror of Darrow in a lot of ways. But what comes out of that just ends up being very disgusting to me. We talked in a previous episode about kind of this great man theory. And this is exactly the kind of mentality that I feel like Lysander has, that like, oh, he's this great man and he can really change things and make things better. But the thing that he is trying to do, the thing he's trying to accomplish, is opposed to like Darrow, who is trying to, you know, for all his faults and for all the fucked up things Darrow does, he is trying to set people free. He is trying to create a republic and a democracy away from a world where the golds ruled everything and enslaved everyone else to greater or lesser degrees. And Lysander, in contrast, believes that the only solution is to return to a world where the golds rule and enslave everyone, because the golds are the only ones who really understand, who really can see how things go and can set things right. And that is just so fucking disgusting to me. And that's why, like, no matter, like, I can understand, Tara, to your point, like, I do think the first 10 years of his life, and frankly, the whole 20 years of his life, have been extremely traumatic for a whole lot of different reasons. I can understand that. But as we've said on previous episodes of the podcast, trauma and struggling with mental health does not excuse any behavior. And one thing that it actually bothers me about the way that Pierce writes Lysander is he does not talk about the potential trauma or mental health struggles that Lysander is going through, because that could make Lysander very relatable. Instead, we get this like very polluted sense of Lysander knows what's best as a 20-year-old, which admittedly, when I was 20, I'm sure I knew what was best. I've somehow lost sight of that in the subsequent 25 years. But I never thought that some race or group of people were the only ones who could shepherd the others and could really show them the true way, specifically by re-enslaving them. Not just enslaving, they've been normalized for centuries at the point where we are introduced to this world, but re-enslaving them after they were freed, because that's the only way that they can truly be brought back as a society. In many ways, to me, that's more disgusting than what Atalantia or any of the other rejects of the society, rejects isn't the right word, they're clearly very much entrenched in the society, but at least with Atalantia and other people who are trying to preserve the concept of the society, they are fighting to hold on to what they have lost. Lysander specifically believes that they have lost. They have lost sight. They have lost where they are, but they need to go back to that. They need to reinstate it, not because they deserve to be in charge because they had that power, but because they are the only ones who can truly lead. And that's the kind of toxic bullshit that is unfortunately extremely rampant in our society. We've seen it particularly in the last, say, 8 years. It's not like it wasn't there before. It's just become more obvious and more vocal. And so I appreciate that Pierce could be shining a light on that, could be shining a light on our own society, and specifically on that point of view with Lysander, and trying to give us some insight into them as humans that can be related to. But all it really does is fucking turn my stomach. And Lysander, I think, is a poor point of view for that, because we don't talk about what could have really led to these beliefs. And frankly, because of the kind of like wishy-washiness of him as a character, we end up with these kind of positions that are at best straw man arguments. I can kind of guess at reasons why Pierce has this character for us, but frankly, I don't have any patience for him. And while Darrow upsets me and pisses me off a lot, Lysander just has no value to me.
So are you saying you do not think he's going to evolve during this series?
He very well may evolve. I certainly hope he evolves.
But I also hope he dies.
Yeah, exactly. Like right now, what I would like more than him evolving is for him to die.
Or well, to evolve and then die, maybe.
I mean, sure. But I would be happy if... So we left this part 1. We left with him basically being fucking owned by Darrow, which was great. But I'm sure he'll ultimately use it to prove why he's really right about golds. Hopefully Pierce will prove me wrong on that one. But I'd be super happy if he just died and we didn't have any more POV from him. I know that's not the case, because I know that, you know, looking at my audiobook, I see that there are still chapters to come from his POV. But if I had looked at the chapters and who the POVs were and I had seen no more Lysander, I'd been like, okay, cool.
Bye forever.
Glad he's gone.
So as we mentioned earlier, Lysander does get upset that his targeting data was used on a group of civilians that included a bunch of children. And he got mad about it, blah, blah, blah. But in the wake of that, he has a conversation with Serafina where he notices that she is fine in that cage, where he had said he felt like a boy from the crowd who thought he could tame lions by stepping in the cage with them. And he notes that Serafina is fine in that cage. She isn't far behind Ajax, who holds the highest kill count of their little mission. When Lysander asks like how things are going for her, she responds that war is conforming to her expectations beautifully. This is a side note and also not a side note. I was meh about Serafina in Iron Gold, but please tell me I am not the only one who just found her completely eye roll inducing in Dark Age. I was not upset when she died. It was a bit of a shock. And I will say that interestingly enough, in a recent chat with fans, Pierce said something along the lines of that he killed her off because he originally planned for her to be Lysander's love interest / a more important character, but he ended up not liking them together, or maybe not liking her all that much, period. And I'm paraphrasing greatly, but that was the general gist. It wasn't like Tongueless where it was like, bam, 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 cut in 4 pieces. There go all those fan theories. What the fuck? I liked Tongueless. I liked the dynamic that was happening there, even beyond the fan theories. I wanted to know more about this character. With Serafina, she died and I was like, oh, that's surprising. Cool.
I thought the death of Serafina was trying to make the point of the impersonal nature of modern warfare. I mean, it was just so random and out of left field that you're like, oh, she, you know, they're just standing there and she gets her head blown off by some random bullet.
Oh, she didn't get her head blown off. She got shot in half. Her intestines were spilling on the ground.
Okay. Point made. But rather than the, you know, the more noble fighting one-on-one with your sword, with your honorable enemy sort of nonsense.
Yeah. Yeah, she was about to, she turned around and was about to talk shit to Lysander, and then it was like, ba-bang! And like Lysander and Cicero duck immediately. Serafina just is so entrenched in her, like, I need to talk shit to Lysander, that she gets cut apart by a railgun.
You say they duck, but you're not ducking from a railgun. It would have just, you know, it was random chance. It could just as easily been Cicero or Lysander who bought it.
They maneuvered.
Whatever. They were probably faster about it. Serafina wasn't. Nobody cares. I mean, yeah, really, though, she was frustrating in Iron Gold, but in Dark Age, she was just like...
mostly useless.
She was so nice in the first trilogy.
When she was a literal child.
She apparently spent more time with her mother than she did with her father.
Shout out to Romulus. You're a real one.
I mean, and also when I listened to the conversation thing that Pierce had with fans, it was a Discord thing a couple of months ago, actually, when he said that he killed her off because he originally planned for her to be Lysander's love interest or like or a more important character. And he ended up not liking them together and also maybe not liking her all that much, period. That's so much better than picking somebody out of a hat. Like, you start writing a character and then you're like, I don't want this one anymore. I like that sort of demonstrable, like, I don't like this one anymore. Bye.
Yes, I will say, and I don't think this is actually what Pierce was saying, but I will say that the potential implication that because she was not a good love interest for Lysander, he decided to kill her off could be a not great take. I don't think that's what Pierce was saying.
No,
I don't think
that's what happened.
I'm just saying, like, that's like, and I only say that because that was so clearly the intent in Iron Gold that she be a potential love interest, even though we learn later that, like, oh, this is mostly a manipulation. From Lysander's point of view, he's still like, oh, but she's still kind of sexy, though.
Well, in Iron Gold, until the end of Iron Gold, maybe, and then he's like,
No, but even in Dark Age, he mentions at the beginning of this book, I'm not sure what the exact quote is, obviously, but it's something to the effect of, like, even though I know what she really is, I'm still, like, kind of turned on right now.
I mean, I think that's just a 20-year-old boy.
Fair. We all made mistakes when we were 20s that were not led from our higher selves.
Last but not least, and we might have other things to discuss beyond this, but I wanted to touch on the possible kind of anti-nod to the Unsullied from A Song of Ice and Fire with the Praetorian info drop. And this is one of those things where it was actually one of the few times where I felt like it was very much like a tell instead of show thing from Pierce, which he usually does the show don't tell stuff very well. But Lysander meets his Praetorians, and it's like when they're out in the desert and they see a Sunblood, which is like a giant carved horse essentially, dying on the sand, and he thinks about what the Praetorians go through to become Praetorians. And apparently before they learn to shoot, they shovel stable stalls and are given a young horse to train. And at the end of their training, they're given a gun and told to kill their horse. The difference between this and the Unsullied in Aesop, because in Aesop, the Unsullied get puppies that they are raised with. And if they do not kill their puppies, they're useless, basically. But in Red Rising Saga, / what we're told in Dark Age, is that the mindless killers that do kill the horses that they helped raise are bound for Black Ops Legion. Basically the people that are going to do the dirtiest, worst shit. But those who prove themselves loyal to their comrades, be they beast or man, are trusted to guard the blood, aka the rulers, not just House Loon, but generally any high-ranking house, and therefore become Praetorians. And I just really like that, because I've always really fucking hated the Unsullied thing from Aesop. And like, I get why it exists, and I get why it's a thing. And I don't know if that's the exact reference he was trying to make, but I love that it got turned on its head. And like, if you kill your horse, you're actually a dickhead. And if you don't kill yes. your horse, you get to become the most trusted of greys. They are the only greys that get to wear star shells, that sort of thing. I liked that because I hate animal murder.
100%.
Then don't see Guardians of the Galaxy 3.
Oh, I did see Guardians of the Galaxy 3. I really liked Guardians of the Galaxy 3. I'm not going to get into spoilers on it. But I also had to divorce myself from some situations when watching it. And I cried a lot. Before I go into In Memoriam, any last thoughts on Lysander's chapters?
Glad they're over for now.
Yeah, for now.
It's funny you say that, because I actually enjoy the chapters. I just don't like him.
That's fair, honestly. And it goes back to something I was saying at the top of the show. Like, I really do credit Pierce for his writing skill, because I so despise Lysander. Like, I don't like Darrow. I despise Lysander. But I do still enjoy reading those chapters. That's a rare feat and one that should be commended.
Yes. Cheers to Pierce Brown's writing skills. So, in memoriam section, we will remember you. Maybe, maybe not. All of these are kind of like an RIP, like maybe thing. Serafina, Aura, ripped in half by the storm god's railgun. Yum, intestines. I mean, I don't care. I'm not sad to see her go. The only thing that could possibly come of this is some issue with the rim now. Because the reason Dido was the one who wanted this war and sent her favored daughter to it. Like, Dido don't give no shits about Diomedes. And Diomedes is the only level-headed person, apparently, in that family right now. Other than maybe Gaia. But Lysander fucked Gaia over. So who knows what the fuck happened to her. Aw, poor grandma. Man, I forgot about that for a second. Damn yeah. it. Anyway, yeah, so... So a rip, sort of, maybe not really, to Serafina. I will say RIP to the many, many Praetorians lost in the Storm God assault, especially the ones who took part in the final charge with Lysander. There were like two or three of them. And I will say this for Lysander, is that the Praetorians who charged with him and Kalandora, they died. And he was like, I didn't even know their names. And he asks their names. I will say they were just dudes being loyal to the only thing they know and fighting hard. RIP to those guys more than Serafina, honestly. As we close out the episode, we just want to give a shout out to our heroes, to your patron, Tommy of the TKOK Podcast Network. Thank you so much for supporting us. Once again, I'm Tara, along with fellow hosts Nick and Jonathan. Don't forget that you can always hit us up at Sagas and Sass on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter, or email us at sagasandsass@gmail.com with any comments or thoughts you might have. Our next episode will cover Virginia's chapters from part 2 of Dark Age. Please consider supporting us at patreon.com/geeksaga_entertainment for early access to our recordings.
Thank you for listening to the Sagas and Sass podcast. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter at Sagas and Sass.